Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we have a healthcare topic for you this morning, and we try to do various topics throughout the year. We have people who specialize in dealing with particular parts of the body, and then occasionally we look at particular health issues. And this morning, we will be talking a bit about diabetes and diabetes care, particularly concentrating on the problem of wound healing, because certainly there are a number of complications that can be associated with diabetes. One of them, the fact that a small injury on the periphery of the body can, if it's not well taken care of, develop into a serious problem. And we'll be talking this morning here with two guests. Both of them work at the Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Dr. Ellen Feil from the Carl Wound Healing and Limb Preservation Center, and Monica Hall. She is a nurse and diabetes educator at Carl. Questions are certainly welcome this morning as we talk with our two guests. And if people have questions about diabetes and diabetes care, I know that they would do their best to answer the question. Whenever we have physicians here on the program, though, I also like to try to caution people that there's a limit to what we can do on the telephone. We can't obviously diagnose over the telephone, but we do these programs to add to your store of health knowledge. So if we can answer questions for you, I know that the two guests will do their best to help you out. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that you may use no matter where you are. As long as we're in the United States, maybe I should make that a qualification. In and around Champaign-Urbana, it's 333-9455, and then toll-free around Illinois, Indiana, or if you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I think that one of the things that we know is that there are a significant number of Americans with diabetes, something over 18 million, I believe, and the number continues to go up. And there has been particular concern. I'm sure people have heard about it. We've discussed it on this program in the past couple of years, particular concern about adolescents developing diabetes. Why does it seem that this is indeed a growing problem here in the United States?
Well, David, probably the biggest problem that we're running into is adolescents and kids not exercising much at all. Sitting at the TV, playing video games. You go by the park, there's nobody playing tennis, nobody's playing ball. The things that I did a lot when I grew up, we're not seeing. It's replaced by the TV. And so a lot of kids are sedentary. They're, unfortunately, the diets that they're taking in, as Monica can second that opinion, is not the greatest, with a lot of high fat, high starch foods. So they're ending up overweight at a younger age, and that's what the trip then is hit, and they're diabetic at very early age, 15, 16, even younger. Now, the distinction is we're talking about type 2 diabetics in younger kids. There's always been and still will be type 1 diabetics, and that's an entirely different situation. That's really not something you can control you control your diet to some degree, but this is more 95% of the time it's type 2 that we're talking about, and that's where weight and being sedentary really is the problem. Type 1 diabetes is basically the pancreas is not functioning, and you have to take insulin for life, and that can be at age 5, 6, 8, it's younger people.
And that was we used to call these childhood and adult diabetes.
Right.
And now
okay.
We have moved away from that, just saying type 1, type 2, apparently, because putting those labels on there would have been a little bit of misleading, particularly, I guess, when it came to type 2, because now, indeed, you don't have to be an adult. It's not just adults that end up with type 2 diabetes.
Right.
Absolutely.
And Monica may could address some of the dietary measures that really we're going to ask any new diabetic to take.
Yes, it's the one important thing is watching your carbohydrates, and particularly people get caught up in looking at sugars, thinking, well, I have to not eat my cakes, candies, candy bars, and they don't look at the total carbohydrates, which is how we are looking at diets now, which is including your sugars like your candies and candy bars, but also your french fries and your potatoes and your rice. And all of those carbohydrates will raise your blood sugars. And so we now are teaching people to don't look at the the sugars in foods, but look at the total carbohydrates, because that is what is going to raise your total blood sugar. Mm-hmm.
So we know that if we ask the question about risk factors for diabetes, it seems that your weight would be one. If you were overweight, that would be a risk factor.
Correct.
And sounds as if your activity level, which may indeed be related to the other thing, are there other particular things that put you at risk, say, aside perhaps from the fact that there might be a history of diabetes in your family?
Yeah, actually, the family history is a very large risk factor. And and you can fool or delay or avoid diabetes, even though you may have the gene and you are primed and ready to go, if you maintain your ideal body weight, for example, or if you are exercising on a regular basis. You may be pre-programmed, so to speak, to have diabetes, but you're not actually going to kick in until you get to, say, 250 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's very important if you have a family history to exercise on a regular basis, try to keep your weight down, and also really very important to be screened. I mean, we also encourage everyone to see their general practice doctor, their family practice doctor, internal medicine doctor, making sure they do fasting blood sugars occasionally, at least once every 5 years. You can do it even certainly more than that. When you're over 40, I'd recommend it more often, but even for young people now, and teenagers, we're really recommending a fasting blood sugar in addition to cholesterol, which is a different topic, but mm-hmm. That's another thing that we want to be screening very carefully. So it is something that's certainly avoidable, and it isn't avoidable in all cases. You have some folks that really are not overweight and maybe are very good at exercising, and they get caught, and it's not fair, I guess you could say, but still, majority of the time, we really can't control some of this ourselves with our behaviors.
Yes, I want to say that there is a newer condition called pre-diabetes. Mm-hmm. And this is when a person's blood sugar is higher than normal, but not high enough to actually diagnose them with diabetes. And this is a real important thing to know whether you have pre-diabetes or not, because at this point, you actually can delay or prevent ever developing type 2 diabetes. And so that is why it is important, as Dr. File said, for people to actually be screened. Because once you are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you will always have it. But if you have the pre-diabetes, you actually can start to exercise and watch your diet and prevent ever developing it.
Well, that's a good point, and I guess that goes to the recommendation that Dr. File made, that everyone, not just people who would be considered to be at risk or people with family history of diabetes, should have their blood sugar screened, because this would be a way of picking up somebody who might be in the pre-diabetes condition when you can really intervene. Take the opportunity to do that, and perhaps you can, as you say, prevent that person from going on and developing diabetes and prevent perhaps eventually having to take insulin and so forth. If you get at the lifestyle things that you can do earlier, they're going to be easier and will increase the chances then that you'll keep that person healthy.
Yeah, that's correct. And honestly, we've sort of dialed down this magic number, so to speak. Since my residency days, where basically you were okay if your fasting blood sugar was less than 140. And now with what Monica's discussing here, anybody that's in the teen, above 105?
100.
100 now. Mm-hmm. So 100 and above. So if you're 110, 112, that might have been ignored 20 years ago. You've been pat on the back and say, okay, you're okay. Now if you're above 100, then you're a player. And basically what I try to tell my patients in the past is, we need to have you believe you're a diabetic right now. I mean, basically, we want folks that are pre-diabetic to get on board and understand what's coming and understand what they can try to avoid and change their diet. Talk to Monica. Get the right diet in place. Get exercise. Let's get with it, because if we just wait and then pretty soon it's 180, 200, 220, you know, then there could be some big problems down the road. We also look at a test called a glycohemoglobin or hemoglobin A1C. There's different terms. It's a more of a long-term look back at how your sugars have been doing the last 3 months or 90 days. And that's a nice barometer to look for folks to see that they really are changing their diet. I mean, they may come in with a number, say 9 or 10 when they're just diagnosed, and they see Monica and then repeat them in 3 or 4 months, they're down to 7, and we get into the 6s, and then we're very happy about that, because that – It's more like the climate, where your sugar on a daily basis is the weather. This gives you more of the climate, so we can look back and say, hey, overall you're doing a good job. There might be those days when the numbers are up, but if your glycohemoglobin is on the way down, then we're pleased.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I guess I just want to make sure that people understand that not when we're talking about people modifying their diet, it's not simply modifying their calorie intake. It's not simply that you're wanting people to lose weight, and indeed you may be wanting people to lose weight and increase their exercise. So it's not just total calories.
No.
It's also where are those calories coming from, and what of the various kinds of things are you eating?
Absolutely, absolutely. We want people to watch their carbohydrates, their fats, and look at their total calories. Mm-hmm. It isn't just a one-step thing. You cannot only look at calories or say, I'm going to totally cut out fat. Because in most foods that are fat-free, they have to still make them taste good. And in order to have fat-free foods taste better, they add a lot of sugar. So you really need to read food labels now. Mm-hmm. And if it's fat-free, look at the amount of carbohydrates. And you will probably see that it is fairly high in carbohydrates, which will in turn raise your blood sugar. And so it is recommended to maybe go halfway and choose light, like light dressing instead of the fat-free salad dressing, which is lower in carbohydrates and lower in fat.
Yeah. I recall some years back there was someone who was pushing a diet for diabetics that was extremely carbohydrate restricted, that virtually told people that, well, from now on, you're never going to eat another potato. You're never going to eat another slice of bread. No more rice. No more pasta, which sounds kind of boring to me. Although I suppose that if you have that condition, and one of the things that this – it was a physician, I think, who was advocating it, said that he had patients who had previously had to use insulin, that as a result of following the diet then no longer had to use their insulin. I guess I wonder what you think about this extreme reduction in carbohydrates, and can indeed you do that? I mean, if you have somebody who is taking insulin and is dependent on that, through dietary modification, can you actually make it so that they don't have to take insulin anymore?
It depends on how long they have been taking insulin, and that diet is only for type 2s. All right.
But,
if you are a type 1, you must actually take insulin. I personally do not like those extreme diets, because typically people do not make wise choices. They will go on a very low carbohydrate diet and pick poor low carbohydrate foods and have the steaks, the big Angus burgers, which are typically high in fat. And then they are clogging their arteries, and they end up with heart problems. But I don't really recommend those really extreme low carb diets. And carbohydrates are not bad. You actually need carbohydrates for fuel. They fuel your brain. And so when people think, oh, carbohydrates are bad, that is wrong. Carbohydrates are not bad. Too much of anything is going to be bad for you.
Yeah, that's really, there's another way to look at it. There's no bad or good food, so to speak. And like Monica's mentioning here, it's more of a balance of what you're doing. Anything that you do to extreme is usually not healthy. I mean, if you exercise too much, that can be not healthy, for example. So really balancing out the act is what we're trying to get at. I mean, a very easy way to look, another easy way to do this is to really pump up the fruit and vegetables. I mean, especially fresh fruit and vegetables. You're going to be taking in low calorie. You're going to have very good food source. You're going to get your vitamins, minerals. And I mean, the recommendation of at least five a day, especially if you're trying to lose weight, can be very beneficial. It takes some planning, and you can easily go a whole day and have no fruit and vegetables, and French fries don't count. But, you know, it's doable.
Well, that, though, raises the question, gets back to the question of the sugar, because I think that people aren't – sometimes people, when they think about sugar, they think of – table sugar, they think of honey. They think of sweeteners, they think of candy. But of course, there is sugar in fruit. And as far as your body is concerned, sugar, sugar. It doesn't really matter where it comes from. Your body's going to process it the same way. Right. Now, but it sounds as if, from what the doctor is saying, that if you follow the standard recommendations for the number of servings of fruit and vegetables, it's for someone who has diabetes, it is okay to eat that fruit? Or are there certain ways that you would suggest people approach it?
Yes. Our dietitians will meet with patients, and they will give them a diet plan, and that is what we call it now is actually a meal plan, not a diet, but a meal plan. And people are given a certain number of carbohydrate choices per meal, and we try to have their carbohydrate choices even for every meal, and with a few as snacks. And typically a person of average size will have 4 to 5 carbohydrate choices per meal. Now, one carbohydrate choice is equal to 15 grams of carbohydrates. And so typically, somebody can have 60 to 75 grams of carbohydrates per meal, and then 1 to 2 carbohydrate choices as snacks if needed.
Mm. This makes it start to sound kind of complicated. Do people actually have to get a kitchen scale? And are you encouraging people to weigh up stuff and measure things that carefully? Does it really matter that much?
Initially, yes. Mm. But honestly, after about two weeks, people can just visualize and they know, oh, this is one serving of fruit, which is going to be my 15 grams of carbohydrate or one carb choice.
Hmm. And one problem, David, is eating out.
Yes.
I'm not going to address that. You may do well at home and control your portions and everything is going fine, but we eat out quite a bit in this town. It's when friends come in, they're always impressed how many restaurants we have here. And so, that's a significant challenge for diabetics. Well, for really people that are overweight in general. So what kind of tips do you give folks for going out to eat?
Well, many restaurants now actually have the calories and fats and carbohydrates broken down. If they don't, you actually can ask for it. They have it at McDonald's, Burger King, Applebee's. Many places now have a new nutritional pamphlet that will break down every meal on their menu. Mm-hmm. and let you know the carbohydrates.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's difficult for people who are concerned about not only their carbohydrates, but are concerned about how much fat they take in. I know just recently we have a physician that's on the program every couple of months, and we got into a discussion of high blood pressure, and we had a caller call in and say, I was trying to be very careful about my sodium intake, and I thought I was doing pretty well. And then I started to look more carefully at how much sodium there was in the food that I was eating. And she said, I was shocked how much sodium there was. And she made apparently a very aggressive effort to try to get her sodium down. And for her, that was very successful. Her blood pressure actually came down. But I'm sure that no matter what the issue is for you, if you're concerned about your diet, it's very difficult. As you say, I'm sure that it's difficult if you eat out, and I'm sure it's difficult if you eat packaged foods because of all the things that go in there. Fats that maybe aren't healthy. You got to look at your carbohydrates. You got to look at how much sugar there is in it. You got to look at how much sodium there is in there. It can be really difficult, I'm sure.
It is hard, but it is very doable. And when you weigh, I want to live a long life. Mm-hmm. It's just important. I just recommend reading food labels. People have got to start looking at food labels and knowing how to actually read it correctly, because food labels are broken down per serving. And so you need to look and make sure that one serving is either the whole box or it may be a fourth of a box. A typical An example is a 20-ounce regular soda. I had a patient think that their 20-ounce soda, the whole soda had 200 calories. Well, that was per serving, and the 20-ounce was actually 2.5 servings. Hmm. And so people really need to look at the servings.
Yeah, and I think that that's also a thing that, that people discover when they look at what, for packaged foods, what sometimes people, that the people who make the foods consider to be a serving, and what your average person considers to be a serving, that we all have this feel, we tend to have the tendency to think of a serving should be much bigger than they think a serving is. So there again, the information is there. You just have to read it and figure out how much it is they're talking about, so that depending on how much of that stuff you
Absolutely.
Eat, you know, are you going to eat 4 Oreos? Or are you going to eat 6? Or are you going to eat 8? What do you think is a serving? Well, it's going to make a big difference, obviously.
Yes.
Well, one thing, David, that, that I think helps motivate people with diabetes, pre-diabetes, I mean, our whole discussion here about food and diet and how it can be difficult is what we're really trying to prevent, I mean, down the road with increased risk of coronary disease, increased risk of actually having kidney failure, kidney disease, vision problems down the road. Those are kind of more front and center. Most people are aware of that. What we're specifically concerned with in the Wound Healing Center is wounds, and the fact that we see a very high volume of complications from patients with diabetes. Diabetic foot ulcers, for example, is a tremendous problem in this country and around the world, and can lead to amputation. Yeah. And that's what we're really striving to prevent that here at Carl, and we can talk about that later.
Well, why don't we do that? But probably it would be a good idea for me to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. Dr. Alan Feil is with the Carl Wound Healing and Limb Preservation Center at the Carl Foundation Hospital, and Monica Hall is an RN, and she is a diabetes educator at the Carl Foundation Hospital. And we're talking about diabetes care, and now we do definitely want to talk a little bit about this wound healing issue. And questions, of course, are welcome. People are listening, and they want to call in, have questions about diabetes and diabetes care. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you mentioned that there are a number of complications that are associated with diabetes. Kidney failure is one of them, problems with the eyes, another. And this problem that you just touched on is one, too, that injuries, sometimes that things that can start out small on the periphery, apparently, particularly in the area of the feet, can, if this goes untreated, can develop into a very serious problem. As you say, if it gets bad enough, you might actually be looking at an amputation. What is the mechanism here? What's going on here?
Well, what happens is essentially with diabetes, there's several things that are not quite functioning right. And you can improve that functioning by controlling your blood sugars. So, I mean, if you have diabetes, you keep tight blood sugar control, your problems will become much less. The basic mechanism is that with diabetes, the small blood vessels to your skin, your muscles, all this, as they get smaller and smaller, that's called the microvasculature. The small blood vessels basically become clogged up, similar to what people know from cholesterol and cholesterol plaquing and so forth. It's a similar mechanism. And essentially then with the decreased blood flow to all these different organs, you run into the biggest problems. Wound healing can be compromised or a problem in patients that have had surgical procedures even, where they may have gone for a C-section or abdominal surgery of some kind, and they're healing okay for a while, but then the wound breaks open or it doesn't close like you'd expect. And so there's a problem, and the problems we run into very frequently are infection. Infections in diabetics is a big issue, because the little cells called white blood cells that help fight infection are not operating correctly, especially if the sugar is very high. They're drunk, more or less. I mean, they don't do their job like they should. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest concerns and the issues that we've tried to promote is prevention. I mean, it's as with basically everything, if you can keep from getting in trouble, you're a winner. And so with diabetes, especially with diabetic feet, we want to make sure that patients look at their feet really on a daily basis. If they can't see down there, or they need to get a mirror to help them see the bottom of their feet, we'd highly suggest that they have their feet screened by their doctor when they go in to see them for their regular physical. Most physicians would do that anyway, but they have to get their shoes and socks off and have the doctor look and look at their feet, see if there's any cracks, for example, cracks, fissures, little tears in the skin can lead to big problems like we discussed. So mm-hmm. the way to help keep that from happening is to really moisturize the feet. We encourage patients to, on a daily basis, use some kind of moisturizer on the bottom of their feet, partly to moisturize their feet and also partly to, quite frankly, get them to look at it, their foot, and make sure there's nothing going on. If they have one of the largest problems we run into is patients with calluses, where they may have had the same callus for years and it's not been a problem, but really a callus is similar to walking on a rock. I mean, if you think about it, you're walking on this push, push, push every time, and it causes pressure and trauma, and then the blood vessels are squeezed and the flow is reduced. So what ends up happening is there becomes a little infection underneath the callus, and very often patients can't feel. I mean, they're called neuropathic, or they can't really sense pain in their feet, so they don't even know what's going on until their sock has blood in it, for example, because now this sore has opened up and it's potentially to the bone. So that's another screening tool that the doctor can help them with. It's called a monofilament. It's like a little fishing wire on an apparatus that you can put on the patient's toe and their heel and so forth. And there's basically 9 places we test. And if they can't feel that, then we know that, and we really can emphasize to the patient, look, you didn't even know that I was pushing this, you know, you should have felt pain or at least a little sensation anyway. Now you can see how important it is to really keep track of your feet and make sure you don't get any sores on it. So prevention is number one, really being careful and wearing socks and shoes at all times. I had a patient a couple of weeks ago that she knew the drill, basically, socks and shoes, diabetic socks, which are a little thicker, but she heard some rustling in the backyard, and she ran out to see what was going on, and she had just gotten out of the shower, apparently, and didn't have her shoes and socks on, and she ended up with a sore on her foot. And 6 weeks later, she's seeing us in the wound center with this sore not healing. So, you know, really, again, I'd emphasize prevention, but then if problems develop, then we're there to help too.
All right. We have a couple of callers. Why don't we talk with them? We have someone on a cell phone. We'll go to first line number one. Hello.
Hello. My question concerns the overweight, and I wondered what changes in the body if a person goes from an acceptable weight to overweight chemically.
Is that something that you is within your area?
You'll end up with an increased risk of certainly it could increase your risk of diabetes if you're normal weight and then you increase your weight. There's the sugar situation certainly can be a problem. There's other changes that can go on too. Certainly your cholesterol can increase. You may be increasing your blood pressure very often. In fact, as probably you talked to the other doctor about blood pressure and how incredible weight loss changes people's blood pressure. They can go from hypertension to not even requiring medicine by losing weight, mm-hmm. especially with the closer ideal body weight. But I don't have any other real thoughts about that, but I think certainly that's...
I would just add that if you are overweight, you don't need to lose enough weight to be within a normal weight for it to do any good. Just losing 5 to 7% of your current body weight can help your blood sugar significantly.
Okay,
and a lot of people are overwhelmed thinking, oh great, I weigh 250 pounds and my body weight should be 150. I cannot lose 100 pounds. I'm not going to even try. They don't have to think of it as losing 100 pounds. Just start out losing just 5 to 7% of their current body weight is going to help them a great deal.
Mm-hmm. And Monica, that's very correct. We at Carl has a weight management program also that I used to be involved with, and we'd see patients losing 5 to 10% to maybe starting off at 300 pounds, going down to 280, and they wouldn't need their blood pressure medicine. It was surprising to me. I mean, we would reduce their blood pressure medicine very quickly because just a 10% change can dramatically reduce the blood pressure and also your sugar. So
yeah.
It's not something that you wake up and go, oh my gosh, I can't lose 100 pounds. Well, it's baby steps, I guess you could say. You got to start someplace, and actually you do get benefit from small changes. So,
well, and I'm sure then it's good all around, because you are also reducing that person's risk of heart attack and stroke.
Absolutely.
In addition to dealing with diabetes, you may be reducing hypertension. We know that people who are overweight have problems with their joints, and it increases problems, back problems, and all kinds of things. I mean, losing weight and being closer to your ideal weight is a good idea for a long list of things. So it has multiple benefits if you can get people to do that.
That's
yes.
Great.
We'll talk with someone here in Aurora on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, I'm sorry to say. I didn't hear spoken of the fact that if people do get diabetes, there's a problem of losing their eyesight. And I remember when I was a student nurse, one of the things I had to do was teach a diabetic person about the probabilities and possibilities of her situation. And she didn't want to hear any of it. She didn't want it. She didn't care. She told me, I don't care if I go blind. And of course, I, being as young as I was, I could not understand it. And that's all I want to say, that to mention the fact that, and I do have a friend now, a bird-watching friend who's going blind. And it's very sad to watch. It's very sad to watch. Thank you.
Nicole, we did certainly touch on that, but perhaps you could more about that.
Certainly that's a critical issue, and we always risk get screened by their physician, usually an ophthalmologist, optometrist, on an annual or semi-annual basis, every few years at least, to make sure there's no early changes. They can pick up on early changes to the retina that you may not really have a problem with your vision yet. And they could see some what are called microbleeds, very small bleeds on the retina, and they could get after that and take care of it early. I mean, that is another complication, just like what we're discussing here and some of the other issues that with wound care and so forth. And I, again, like I mentioned before, I want to really emphasize prevention, but there is hope, and there's a lot of things that we do at the Carl Wound Healing Center to help folks get on their way and not have to deal with some of the devastating effects that can occur if left undone or untreated.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that, Monica, your job really involves, once a person has had that diagnosis, once they have been told that they're diabetes or have diabetes or perhaps in the pre-diabetic condition, yes, then you see them. And you're the person that whose job it is to try to help them understand the condition and what they can do in terms of modifying their lifestyle to be healthier.
Exactly.
Do you find that most people, what sort of attitude do they come with when they meet with you for the first time?
Most people are really receptive to education. Mm-hmm. I do have a few who, as our last caller said, they just do not care. And so what you have to do is find what they really care. For one person, it may be that I tell them that they will not, you know, live to actually see their children's children grow up. And that motivates them to actually start testing their blood sugar, watching their diet, and starting to exercise. Because I do find people who really do not care. They will have their leg cut off or have their eyes, you know, go bad or be on dialysis, but they care about, say, planting their garden. And if they find out that if they lose feelings in their fingers and they cannot actually, you know, plant their garden, they really care about that. Mm-hmm. And so my job is to actually try and find what they really care about and what will motivate them to actually start caring for themselves. Mm.
I'd like to give Dr. Fowle a chance to talk a little bit more specifically about what it is that you do.
Okay.
In terms of treatment, you have somebody that has a stubborn wound or resistant wound or it's just not healing properly, what exactly do you do?
Well, it takes a multidiscipline approach, really. We have vascular surgeons on staff with us, plastic surgery we consult with, dermatologists, the infectious disease doctors are actually on staff with us also, a physical medicine rehab doctor, Dr. Jane, who started the program himself. And When a patient comes in to see us, we really have a fairly in-depth discussion about their past history, what got them here, what problems they may have medically. For example, some patients with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or on prednisone have problems healing. And we can identify that and perhaps change something that they're doing with their medicine. Some medicines people take in fear of healing. So it's a pretty... The initial visit does take quite a bit of time and just trying to investigate, looking under each rock, making sure we're not missing anything. Then one of the most important parts, especially diabetics, is to make sure that their vascular supply is adequate. So we do arterial study tests and make sure that they're okay, because if they don't have blood going down to their leg, a lot of things that I would do locally to their wound is a waste of time. And so once we get that cleared up, say they need to see our vascular surgeon, perhaps get a bypass or get a balloon, the same kind of treatments that people have with their heart. I mean, as far as fixing their, you know, when they have a coronary artery cath and so forth, they do that to the leg. So we get that taken care of, and we still may be looking at problems with the wound not healing. So then we get into a little higher tech level of treatment. And we have now... we're using a product called Dermagraft. There's another product called Applegraft, which actually is derived from skin cells called fibroblasts, and those are the little cells that really are very important in healing a wound. It's kind of like the wood to your house. I mean, you have to have the fibroblast there. You're going no place. Those cells were developed actually from a circumcised baby. The circumcised baby, they cultured the cells out, and it's the same cell line now. I think it's been going on for 10 years, and these cells have grown to cover approximately 6 football fields worth of this graft. So actually, we're able to implant this or place it on the patient's skin, and they don't have to have another it's not surgery. They don't have to have their, like, a skin graft where you take a piece of skin from the from their back or their hip. We can implant it into the wound, and then it activates the healing process. And especially in diabetics, there's a significant detriment in the what are called growth factors. These are chemicals that call on all the folks that need to get into the wound to heal it. So that's one of the things we use. Also, we have nanotechnology derived products. One is a silver product that we use that has crystals, and it's very small crystals, and it has a terrific killer of bacteria on the skin. So we can avoid antibiotics in the mouth and the side effects from systemic antibiotics by placing products on the wound and trying to get them back to healing. We just opened last week is hyperbaric oxygen treatment. And this is exciting as well, because we're going to now be able to increase that oxygen flow to the patient's feet or the wound. And it's not just feet, but that's for this discussion. We can talk about that. And by way of increasing the oxygen flow in patients' plasma. As we're sitting here right now, our red blood cells are doing a great job. They're basically taking all the oxygen in the air and about all that they can get, and we're at the top level right now. Well, if you have a diabetic wound that's not healing or going the wrong direction, and you've been revascularized, or you've seen we've got the artery doctors taking care of it as best they can, the oxygen that we deliver at pressure is actually absorbed into the plasma, or the water part of your blood, you know, the not the red blood cells, but the plasma. And then it's able to get very close to the wound and diffuse out and touch the wounded area. The chamber that we have was developed by a company called Perry. We have two of these chambers. And Perry originally started by making submarines, essentially. And we now have these two chambers, and patients actually are completely in the chamber. So it's not, you don't put oxygen on a little tube and stick it on the wound, for example. You have to breathe this and get it into your bloodstream so that it'll absorb and go down to where the wound is. It's a comfortable environment. People can watch TV. They can bring their DVDs in there. We have there's a hyperbaric tech that's there with them the whole time, and we screen them, of course, for this procedure. But we're very excited about it, because in some cases, really, there is no other alternative. I mean, they've done everything. They've been every place, and now we're still looking at a spot that really is a problem and a potential risk for them down the road as to getting amputated. Another area where this is very exciting and helpful is patients. Some patients add radiation to their face or their jaw, their head and neck, for like squamous cell cancers from tobacco or from chewing tobacco or other reasons, Hodgkin's, and there's various different cancers. But what could happen is you get the radiation treatment, and the skin or the muscle can be damaged. And this can happen also, for example, to the rectum. When people have colon cancer, they may get radiation, and the radiation can damage their that area down there as well, the colon, and they can get a proctitis, it's called, or other areas too. Some patients have had radiation in their bladder, and they get what's called a cystitis, or it's from basically radiation, because radiation, once it hits your muscles and your skin and so forth in a controlled dose, that's great. But sometimes when the dose gets a little too much, and you may require that to help your cancer, then unfortunately the bone and the skin become normal. There's very low blood flow. The skin it's called hypoxic, and by doing the hyperbaric oxygen treatments, we can see alter their course. One thing that I would want to make sure your listeners understand or hear is, mm-hmm. if they themselves have ever had radiation treatment for a head and neck or for a jaw or a tongue or any of those areas, and if they require at some point down the road need to have a tooth pulled, for example, or need some kind of a dental procedure where they're going to be either the dentist may have to scrape a little bone or the gum or anything that's going to be going on in there, I would 100% dentist is made aware of the fact that they had radiation treatment before, because they very much set up for a significant problem. It's called osteoradionecrosis, and what that basically means is this tissue we know is abnormal. It's abnormal 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. It stays abnormal after the radiation treatment. So at any point down the road, whenever they get their tooth pulled, there's a high risk of infection developing into the mandible and the jawbone. And basically it can lead to disfigurement. Plastic surgeons and oral maxillofacial surgeons do a very good job of trying to curb this, but it can really get out of hand in a hurry. And if they know that, they can come to see us before they have the procedure. We do the hyperbaric oxygen treatments, about 20 of these treatments, and then they can have the procedure done much more safely with much less risk of any bad sequelae down the road. Then there's protocols that we follow. These are developed over time. It's kind of interesting, the history of this hyperbaric oxygen, and it goes back to actually Eads Bridge in St. Louis is one of the places where it was used initially when they were building the caissons and sinking tube down into the Mississippi River, and patients were getting real sick and having decompression illness, and they figured out, wait a minute, we might be able to do something here. And from that point onward, we have really gotten this to a science. And hyperbaric oxygen really took it on the chin. In the late 20s, there were some charlatans out there, and they were putting people in. They even built a hotel, hyperbaric oxygen hotel, where you go in and, spend a couple nights and feel great. And that's, of course, baloney. But we now replaced it with really a scientific model, and controlled studies show the outcomes to be very, very good. And that's what we're doing at Carle. So it's really another thing that we do in the continuum of wound care. I mean, besides our regular visits where we're going to be taking care of their wounds and trying to clean it up and do whatever we need, that's another option that's really exciting.
We have a caller here. We'll get to it. And perhaps I should again introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 15, 20 minutes. Our last person here speaking is Dr. Alan Feil from the Carle Wound Healing and Limb Preservation Center at Carle Foundation Hospital. Also here with us is Monica Hall. She's an RN, and she's a diabetes educator. And we started out talking about diabetes, and we have been talking a little bit here about wound healing, which can be an issue for people with diabetes, but not just for people with diabetes. Questions are certainly welcome. We have about 7-8 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone listening this morning in Chicago with a call on our toll free line. Line 4. Hello.
Thank you. This has been most informative. I really appreciate it. On the education side, I'd heard some reference to the use of cinnamon as a facilitating metabolism of your food. So a comment on that as another thing that's being used. Some products are now being produced that way, as well as recommending sprinkling cinnamon on your food in a certain way. Is there anything that you've observed or known about this?
Well, actually, I have just read one article on the use of cinnamon in helping to lower a person's blood sugar. As I say, if it works for you, that is fine. But typically, it will only lower your blood sugar just a a little bit from what I have read. I really haven't read much on it. But the one article that I saw, it did lower a person's blood sugar a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I was also going to ask about the this particular index that some people can refer to, talking about the high sugar content. I forget the name of that particular index.
Glycemic index.
Oh yes, yes. Yes. Could you comment on that briefly? I'll hang up and hear you off the air.
All right.
Okay. Yes. This is a newer meal plan that some people feel that following a glycemic index meal plan is best. This is based on its principle is based on that every food has a certain a glycemic index, meaning that it will raise your blood sugar either quickly or slowly. If there is a food with a high glycemic index, that means it would raise your blood sugar quickly. If it has a lower glycemic index, it means it'll raise it more slowly. And the thought is that if you keep your meal plan towards the lower glycemic index foods, you will have better blood sugar. For some people, it works great, but you must keep in mind that a high glycemic food may actually be a lower one for you, or a lower glycemic food that is listed on a table may actually work as a high glycemic food for you. And there are books and tables that actually list out, certain foods and whether they are high or low, and you must look, because not all lower glycemic foods are good for you, and not all high glycemic foods are bad. For example, a lot of fruits are on the higher glycemic food list, but they are very good for you because they are lower in fat and lower in calories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And different people respond to different foods differently, so that means that something that would be on the high end for one person might not be on the high end for somebody else?
It is typically on the high end for everybody, but for you, for some reason, it may be on the middle to low.
Okay.
But typically, the higher foods are high for everybody, and the lower ones are lower for everybody.
Who is it that has to do frequent testing of their blood sugar themselves? I know that there are some people who do this, and now there are devices that are available for that, and that there are some people that periodically throughout the day have to check their blood sugar maybe some number of times. Who, and is this primarily, we're talking about people who are insulin-dependent diabetics who have to do this, or do more people have to do this?
Well, everyone should, check. Every person with diabetes should check their blood sugars. If you are taking insulin, we typically say to test at least 4 times every day, and that is before eating breakfast, before eating lunch, before eating dinner, and before going to bed. If your blood sugars are consistently within goal range, which is typically 90 to 130 before eating, and your A1C is less than 7, then you may, go down to testing twice every day, but alternating times. So one day test before eating breakfast and before eating dinner, and then the next day test before eating lunch and before going to bed. And that twice a day with alternating times is typically what I tell patients who are taking oral medications to also test at that frequency.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point that we have to finish. Is there any last sort of thing that you'd like to leave with people?
I would encourage patients to not be afraid to show their doctor their wounds, quite frankly. I mean, sometimes there's a long thing, many things they want to discuss with their doctor, and they may not realize that what they should be discussing is the sore on their foot that's been there for 6 weeks or 2 months or longer, and they're in with other things. So early identification is very important and can make their lives a lot easier down the road. So that'd be my parting information, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And probably for everybody, we want to make sure that, and do consult your physician about this, but everybody periodically ought to have their blood sugar checked.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much. Monica Hall, she's an RN and is a diabetes educator. Dr. Alan Feil is with the Carl Wound Healing and Limb Preservation Center. They both work at Carl Foundation Hospital. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.